Today is Wednesday, March 7th. It is 1:02 p.m. and just wanted to get us going because I know we have a full committee meeting today. Members present at this time, Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Dave Tallarico, Representative George Rauscher, Vice Chair Representative John Lincoln, Co-Chair Representative Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Garen Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. If we could ask everyone to please silence your cell phones as we get started, we'd appreciate that. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast. Thank you. And LIO moderator,
Leah,
thank you so much for your help today. This afternoon, we have a presentation that's going to be, I think, a really exciting presentation entitled The Economic Benefits of Public Lands in Alaska for Small Business Development. And then we have the first hearing of House Bill 272, the Tangle Lakes State Game Refuge. Excuse me. So the first order of business will be the hearing on outdoor recreation. We have a number of testifiers to present on the economic benefits of public lands in Alaska. So we're going to invite the presenters up and have them do their presentation, and then we'll take a few questions after each presenter. And they're mostly verbal presentations, not PowerPoints, but there are a number of documents at your seat, and folks might refer back to those documents as they do their presentation. These folks are in town for a fly-in, and they're here to talk about the developing outdoor adventure industry in Alaska, and I think we have an important role to play as the Resources Committee with jurisdiction over the Department of Natural Resources. Of course, we have Division of Parks and Recreation under our purview, as well as Division of Land, Mine, and Water. So we're trying to explore, just like we did on Monday. We, you know, are very blessed to be land rich. We have lots and lots of public lands, and so, you know, we're trying to explore some of the other opportunities. We talked on Monday again about the development of the agriculture sector, today about looking at the outdoor adventure recreation sector, and how do we as a state, you know, manage what we have, the lands and the infrastructure, to help both of these industries develop and bring new economic opportunity to our state, provide, you know, new jobs for our young people to stay here and encourage that Alaska spirit and entrepreneurial spirit of our residents. So with that, I want to bring our first speaker up, and I will just recognize that we've been joined by Representative Birch. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Thank you, and Representative Drummond. So we do have a full committee at this time. Thank you. So our first presenter is Lee Hart. If Lee would please come forward. Lee Hart is the executive director of the Valdez Adventure Alliance, founder of Confluence, two coalitions dedicated to growing Alaska's economy through the mountain sports lifestyle. Lee is also chair pro tem of the Valdez Economic Diversification Committee and chairs the newly formed Recreation Subcommittee of the Alaska BLM Resource Advisory Council. For nearly 20 years, Lee has conducted public relations outreach on behalf of leading brands in the outdoor, snow sports, bike, and adventure travel industries. I do think that that sort of prop might be something that you brought along, and I'm just going to ask you, because one member didn't like that we have a prop, that so at the end of your presentation, if you would please remove that. So with that, if we would love to hear from you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you, co-chairs Tarr and Josephson, and the members of the House Resources, Natural Resources Committee. I appreciate you creating this opportunity for this conversation in our state capitol today. I'm here with a delegation to help illuminate opportunities for the state to create jobs, diversify the economy, and stimulate rural economic development, all by playing to our inherent and arguably biggest strength as the last frontier state, the last, best, vast, wild, open place in the United States. With me today, I have colleagues who represent a cross-section of stakeholders from the outdoor recreation industry. We are here to talk about the economic value of the industry that many rightfully call a sleeping giant. This effort started, as Rep. Tarr mentioned, with the creation of the Valdez Adventure Alliance just 2 years ago. Our mission is to diversify our economy in Valdez through the development and promotion of mountains, of activities and projects that support a mountain sports lifestyle. We've, to that end, we've managed three different sporting events, two in the winter and one on the beginnings of summer. So Ice Climbing Festival, a Fat Bike Festival, and a Rock and Yoga Festival. We also manage four state park units, which otherwise would have been closed had we not responded to an RFP keep, and we now manage four units, and we're very proud to do that. We get about 100,000 visitors a year through our area that pass through those units. So that led to the creation of Confluence, which started, we had our very first Confluence conference in June of 2016. And the reason, the rationale was that I could be more successful doing what we're trying to do, improve in Valdez, if there's more fertile ground around us in the state. And what we found was that, so we hosted what we call a non-denominational gathering of diverse voices with a stake in Alaska's great outdoors. So winter, summer, motorized, non-motorized, hunters, anglers, snowboarders, kayakers, climbers, and bikers from academia, from manufacturing, from government, nonprofit, retail, military, and even public health. In that meeting, we confirmed that there was a depth and breadth of political will to coalesce around the notion that we should join forces to convince elected officials to empower and enable the overlooked industry so that it may reach its full potential. Alaska has a unique opportunity to diversify its economy and accelerate its growth with a coordinated effort to boost recreation activity on public lands. There is untold upside investment in rural development hinges upon its success. So in order to highlight exactly how this sector fits into an economic picture, I used as a basis the five-year strategic plan, North to Opportunity, Alaska's economic strategy. And I plugged in how that would fit if you added in the terms and the concepts for outdoor recreation. And, you know, the economic strategy is the trail map for the state for creating a stable and sustainable economy that generates quality jobs, capital investment, and new revenue to benefit the people and businesses of Alaska. Yet within the study, as we have it was created in 2016, there's no reference to outdoor recreation, but that's not really anybody's fault. It was because the industry is still being recognized as its own economic sector. And you have, on the one sheet that I left behind for you, you have data from that is newly released from the U.S. Department of Commerce that considers outdoor recreation as a satellite account and shows that it contributes $374 billion to the U.S. Economic impact from our industry. You also have charts that show how that's broken out across different major sectors, and that the sector accounts for 2% of U.S. GDP, and growth in the sector outpaces economic growth overall. So now there's this recognition, right, from the federal level of this sector and its power. And even Secretary of Commerce Ross said it was, the numbers surprised him as well and should surprise many consumers, but it doesn't surprise those of us who have been enjoying this for quite some time. So anyway, to again relate it directly to your Northern Opportunity Strategic Economic Plan, I went through some of the areas. So the first area in that plan talks is great big section developed to business development. So to cultivate a resilient business climate that supports growth and expansion of existing and emerging industries. To increase the total number of visitors to the state by 5% annually and demonstrate an increase in rural community visitation, increase shoulder season and winter visitation by 5%. Well, this industry is perfectly set up to be that mechanism to get you there. We're doing it in Valdez, as I mentioned, with those festivals I referred to, and with those we attract a steady base of enthusiasts of those sports to our community in otherwise pretty dead seasons for our community. So other points within this business development section talk about increased capital investment and subsequent jobs in rural Alaska, creating new and supporting existing business mentorship programs in rural Alaska. You'll hear some of these points also addressed by my colleagues in greater detail. engaging in public relations campaigns that highlight the importance and economic impact of uniquely Alaska products and services, like some of the sports we've developed and exported basically around the world, including pack rafting and fat biking, not to mention the PR value we get from many of our homegrown Olympians, two of whom recently got gold, and talked a lot about their winter recreation in our state. The plan also calls for increasing sustainable growth in emerging visitor industry segments that fit exactly with outdoor recreation, which is ecotourism, geotourism, adventure travel, and Arctic tourism, the emerging market, by the way, of Arctic tourism, and also increasing shoulder season and winter visitor capacity and infrastructure by promoting Alaska-specific products, iconic features, and events that are target markets. So the holy trinity, I think we can agree, in the visitor industry is Northern Lights, bears, and glaciers, and we've got that in spades. And as far as the events, really, there's a lot of room for growth there. The only one that I would argue, and others who run their events probably would argue it even more strenuously, is that our best-known event is the Iditarod. It does have global name recognition and viewership and stuff from around the world. But there's plenty of other things that we do that could also rise to that level with some marketing support. The strategic plan also calls for continuing assessing the unmet workforce needs through business retention and expansion surveys and other outreach. Now, Thor has some information about the hunting sector that is quite interesting, but there's other opportunities. For example, I know that in Valdez, our the climbers that I use to teach people in the clinics that we have at the Ice Fest and the heli-skiing clients that come are guided largely, the climbing guides and the heli-skiing guides are largely from the lower 48. There is absolutely no reason that those jobs shouldn't be cultivated here within our youth and grow into. These are professional careers with a lot of expertise behind them in wilderness first aid and all kinds of certifications to approve acumen in these sports. And we have it right here. And I would love to see that we get to that place where we have more homegrown guides in these worlds. They do exist elsewhere. The next section in the strategic plan talks about finance and investment, maximizing the productive use of capital for Alaska business expansion. I think you can see where I'm going with this. And to that end, it also calls for creation of a formal report on sources and gaps in available capital for all business investment in Alaska. And I'm happy to tell you, in case you don't already know, that the Division of Commerce and Community Economic Development has already commissioned the University of Alaska to conduct an emerging markets study of outdoor recreation. That study is beginning shortly, if it hasn't already begun, and our intent is that we would release the findings from that study in conjunction with the next Confluence Conference this fall. Another goal is to maximize existing sources and seek new sources of capital that spread out risk to multiple parties. In this case, they were referencing the Bureau of Indian Affairs, USDA, and USSBA, which are all obviously quite valid. To that, if you color it through the lens of outdoor recreation, you might also talk about the USDA's U.S. Forest Service arm and the BLM, National Park Service, and our own state division of natural resources, and leveraging what each of those bodies are doing, and coordinating some of that outreach. So we also want to point in the study says involve local community foundation affiliate organizations in the facilitation of organizational capacity building, and again, through our lens, I would argue that you could include, there's so many community-based trails organizations, and Chris Beck will talk to that in a bit. under the topic of enterprise infrastructure. It suggests building the transportation and technology foundations for economic growth. In outdoor recreation, our infrastructure are trails and things like hut-to-hut systems. And what we know, and we would also envision being part of a roundtable to work with other industries, homegrown industries here in Alaska, to mitigate some of the daunting challenges of exporting and shipping our products elsewhere, that are some of the innovative products developed here. We want to join in positioning Alaska to thrive in a technologically advanced global economy and increase the pipeline of bankable startup companies in Alaska by 10%. That's a goal. And I would encourage all of us in this room to begin to have this awareness that let's expand how we think about entrepreneurship and innovation. It's not just, those are not just terms that have to be stuck in tech. And, you know, and we have it here. Our environment inspires some amazing technology. Think about even the in the aviation industry and the bush pilots and some of the technology they develop for having short takeoffs and landings on postage stamps. I consider and they wouldn't do that if there weren't people demanding to get into our backcountry. So support and expand Alaska's startups as central through a central online statewide hub of startup information, events, resources, and partnerships, which I can assure you some of my friends who have started some of these actual entire industries here in Alaska would have appreciated when they were getting going. Under economic development and capacity building, the plan calls to strengthen the ability of Alaska organizations to execute economic development initiatives that create jobs and investment. And with this industry, I am suggesting that those jobs and investments would be by and for Alaskans. So the next section calls for quality of life. And here, there is no question that outdoor recreation is the shining mechanism to enhance quality of life here. So we excel in spades and could finish many of the sentences in this section with outdoor recreation. So improve the attractiveness and livability of Alaska communities to attract and retain quality workforces and set the foundations for economic well-being through improved access to outdoor recreation. Utilize new metrics to inform and implement quality of life programs on a local level with outdoor recreation programming. Assess options for reducing the cost of health insurance and individual health care programs with outdoor recreation. The sports that we do are lifelong skills that people practice in well into beyond what we would call retirement age right now. So the one place in the plan that I was proud to see mentions, at least ancillary mention, of outdoor recreation is the call to expand and promote recreational access to public lands, right in our wheelhouse. Also says that it identifies various industries, existing industries that are fast growing and that are likely to remain so for the coming years. We're not listed on there, but again, nobody knew to kind of consider us as that sector. So now I'm challenging you all to think about that way. For, in fact, the state has quite a considerable impact on our economy with $7.3 billion in consumer spending, 72,000 jobs, and $2.3 billion in wages and salaries generated from those jobs. And these are not just the, you know, minimum wage, unskilled labor, seasonal jobs. We're talking about people making lifestyle decisions on the careers that they pursue as they build their families, send their kids to college, and do everything the rest of us enjoy. Well, I'm in that industry. So The SWOT analysis, interestingly, calls out the natural beauty that attracts visitors and new residents. Yet within the opportunities section of that SWOT analysis, it does nothing to reference what we might do to channel that. So one of the things I did was I looked at I took some stats just as a just to pull something out that's tangible. So we looked at National Park stats, service stats from Denali, which is well known, and actually the giant gorilla with $600 million of economic output in our state. And then I looked at the other, like I picked one out of thin air that not many people, even Alaskans, are familiar with, Kobuk Valley National Park. And even that one generates $24.4 million in visitor spending. It is not on the road system, as you all, many of you hopefully know. And so, you know, what if we were to market some of our other parks besides Denali? You know, I would argue Denali with the highest national, you know, peak in North America kind of is its own draw, but and these other parks are spectacular. So why invest in the outdoor recreation sector? It's recession resistant, it grows Alaska jobs for Alaskans, and we have the best building blocks in the country, as described on page 32 of this report I keep referencing, where Alaska has 34,000 miles of marine shoreline, 3 million lakes, marshlands, and wetlands, permafrost all over the place, and glacial ice covering 28,000 square miles of Alaska. Alaska home to some of the biggest mountain ranges in the world. We've got the building blocks to really do something with this. So how do we get started? I would argue that one of the ways is just starting with something we know, which is preserving and sustaining funding for Alaska State Parks. They have some capital requests, and I hope those make it through to final budget approval, because they're there to help make the state parks more self-sustaining, which is the goal all along. And then the other one is to remember to include outdoor recreation, or at least how it might play a role as you plan programs and invest in initiatives today that will pay dividends for the economy, health, and lifestyle of our state for generations to come.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And do you want to show this video clip?
We'll show that later in the presentation.
Okay.
Segue.
Yeah. Okay.
Sequence. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And so, are there questions for Ms. Hart? Representative Drummond.
I appreciate all this incredible information. Is that report that you're referencing available to us to study in greater detail?
Which one? I referenced a couple.
The one that you're working from.
Northern Opportunity, Alaska's Economic Strategy, is a product of the State Office of Economic Development. So you can request that from them.
And Representative Drummond, we'll try to get that and send that out to all the committee members. I think that we should be able to find that pretty easily, right? Okay. I'm getting yes from the division director. Any other questions for Ms. Hart? I have one. I'm just wondering, with some of these festivals, because, you know, I have an interest, obviously, you know, in this area. And when I first moved to Alaska, I spent my summers guiding. And so we know there's an industry for the summer. But this idea of the winter travel and how do we get more winter visitors, with the festivals that you've started, have you looked into the point of origin, if you will, of where people came from? Are they, you know, traveling from Anchorage to Valdez, or are we getting people from outside?
Our recently concluded ice climbing festival is the biggest festival that we have. It's one of the oldest ice fests in the world. And this past event that just concluded a couple weeks ago, the majority of people were, in fact, from Anchorage and Fairbanks. But we had a visitation from 12 states and two countries, Mexico and the Czech Republic. The ice climbing community, and with, you know, they are willing to travel to enjoy their sport in other places. And the Valdez area has a reputation for actually iconic and ridiculous ice features, natural ice features. Many other ice festivals in the lower 48 farm ice, but ours is all natural.
Very cool. Representative Johnson, pardon me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you don't have to convince me of the value of outdoor recreation and the value to Alaska. There's no question about that. I have to say my daughter just came back from the ice festival and her ice climbing in Valdez, so I always breathe a little easier when I know that she's off the ice. So anyway, very good. Growing up in Talkeetna, I know that quite a value in all of the outdoor sports and hunting and all the value that brings to Alaska. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say I appreciate the presentation. I appreciate the information you provided is very it's very thick. It's very thorough. There are probably permanent job questions or residential actual job questions, but outside of that, I realize the market is definitely needs to be improved, and it has a long way to go, and it is already one of the main drivers in the state, and I really appreciate you taking up the interest there and trying to make it happen even more. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions? I had one final one just on the rural community development piece of it. I think that's something that, you know, is something we really should be thinking more about and sort of studying more, and just thinking of a couple of our members' districts here that, you know, to the extent we can get people recreating in those areas, that's going to support, you know, the restaurants, the gas stations, and everything else. You mentioned that as a key component of that, but I just wonder if you have any additional thoughts on how we might be thinking about that, or if your group is working with some of the leadership in smaller communities to kind of bring some of that infrastructure or conversation.
Chris Beck and I actually we gave a presentation about a year ago to the statewide convention of city planners, and had a sold out house for that, and a lot of great interaction from people working within the cities and bureaus for planning their recreation. And it was a very well-received presentation, so I think that that's another avenue we can look at. But I do believe that many of the jobs and the guide services and lodges and all of that are essentially small businesses, but small businesses are the backbone of the American economy, and that's where people can, and the other thing is that people can choose to live wherever they want more readily than they used to, thanks to internet technology, and so they are choosing life. They are making their decisions on what communities to stay in based on those. So we also know that access to outdoor recreation is an important consideration for, in particular, early stage at this point, you know, career people looking into starting their careers. So I think there's plenty of opportunity to talk about how some of our rural communities and villages could benefit.
Representative Lincoln has a question.
I have a question. So we learned a little bit about the marketing and the effective tourism and the Arctic Policy Economic Development Committee recently. I'm just wondering are you aware of the decrease in state spending on statewide tourism marketing? Is that something that is concerning to you, or are you aware of the bill that we're looking at in that committee? Do you have
I am, and I'm quite aware of that. One thing I didn't put in my bio is I was a marketing director for a tourism board in Colorado for 6 years. In a county there, Mountain County. So I'm very tuned in and plugged in with tourism, and Dan Blanchard here is here to speak to some of that as well. So we are aware of that. We know that I know that when the budgets are cut, it's imperative for those agencies to deliver the numbers. So it refines their targets, and so if we can get to a place where we're restoring that marketing funding, we can spread that out and pick new targets to draw people's interest toward. In fact, if you look further in the National Park Service data at Kobuk Valley National Park, you can see, and as well as many of the other small parks, you can see a direct corollary between a downturn in their in visitor spending and stuff there that almost parallels exactly the decline of marketing revenues for ATIA.
follow-up?
Is that something you have handy? Is that you could, can you provide that? Or
it's I don't have it handy, but it is readily available and searchable. On there's a National Parks, and we can send you a link to where you can see that information.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I think then we'll transition to our next speaker. and, of course, Ms. Hart will be here, so we may have additional questions as we go forward. So if Thor Stacy could please come forward. Mr. Stacy is a lifelong Alaskan, born in 1978 in a cabin in Indian, Alaska. This year is his 19th year guiding hunters in Alaska. He grew up with a passion for hunting, fishing, and wilderness adventure. His family made their living operating a small placer mine in the Arctic, 7 miles north of Wiseman. He was employed in the guide industry as a packer in 1998 while he was still serving in the United States Marine Corps Reserve. Thanks to the understanding and flexibility of his reserve unit, he became a licensed assistant guide in 2000 while still serving in the reserve. He's also worked as a miner, commercial fisherman, trapper, and timber feller. He currently has a federal hunting guide concession in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where he guides hunts for sheep, grizzly bears, caribou, and wolves. He's represented the Alaska Professional Hunters Association in the legislature since 2012. Welcome, Mr. Stacy.
Thank you, Co-Chair Tarr and Co-Chair Josephson, members of the House Resource Committee. I'm here on behalf of the president of the association, Sam Rohr, who's in Kodiak. With the short timing of the hearing, he couldn't make it, so I volunteered to present here on behalf of the group. If you look in your packet, I presented just an outline of where I intend to go today. My goal is to provide a very brief sketch of the guided hunting industry here in the state. You'll hear a lot about new opportunities, a lot about new potential, new outdoor activities, growth opportunities. However, the guided hunting industry is probably the oldest outdoor recreational industry here in the state. Miners and trappers started to take visiting hunters out in the field for Alaska's big game probably in the 1920s. There may have been some earlier activity. And so the accompaniment of visiting hunters here in the state of Alaska has been going on since territorial days and continues till now. With that, I'm going to start off with what is a hunting guide. Hunting guides are licensed professionals here in the state. We have to hold a license to conduct guide activities. And you don't become a licensed hunting guide by going to school. There's no vocational program. Becoming a licensed hunting guide is only done through on-the-job training, usually coming up as a packer. So that avenue to becoming a licensed professional is very unique in this modern world. That opportunity is open to many rural Alaskans and even some non-Alaskans. Hunting guides accompany their visiting clients in the field. We safely, the first goal is to provide a safe adventure. These trips are usually 7 to 10 days in length. We identify the desirable animals to pursue. We cook for them. We take care of physical ailments. We cheer them on. We pack heavy items and gear. We answer questions. We let them use our electronic communication so they can talk to their family. We provide logistic support. But most importantly, a really solid interpretive experience. Our clients hunt all over the state in very remote parts of Alaska. And hunting guides, by and large, know a lot about the natural environment, the surroundings, and the people and the history of those areas. It's a very strong interpretive experience at its most, and there's absolutely no guarantee that a client will harvest an animal. Non-visiting hunters that wish to hunt doll sheep, round bear, or mountain goats are required to hire a guide, although visiting hunters do choose to hire guides for animals such as moose, caribou, deer that are not required to hire a guide. So, for purposes of safety and navigating difficult terrain, for the legislature in the state has said, hey, look, Alaska is a dangerous place. These are dangerous animals. We want you to be accompanied by a licensed professional. Okay, moving to number two here on our presentation list, I'm going to give you a kind of a brief overview of the economics and the economic impacts that come with the guided hunting industry here in the state. I'm going to reference two recent McDowell reports. You'll notice that one kind of has these pictures or kind of a overview. This was done in 2015, or a report. It was actually finished in 2016, but it's based on 2015 numbers. And then you'll see the pages here. This report was done in 2012. And while both reports are on the economics of the guide industry, the 2012 report was very in-depth and detailed as far as things like guide residency and rural impact, while as the 2015 report was more of an update. So they're the same industry, same group, but they're slightly different, and both complete reports are in your packet. First off, we have a total in 2015. We had a total of $87.2 million of economic activity in the state. That was $52.5 million new dollars to the state economy, with a total of 3,240 guided trips in the state. From a big picture, that represents about 3% of the allocation. So 3% of the hunting opportunities in the state were our customers, a very small percentage of the total hunting effort in the state at this time. Moving to the second page, I'm just going to kind of flip and move through this to keep us on track and let the folks behind me have plenty of time. We have a really high rate our guide businesses are small businesses. It says here most contracting guides, about 80%, serve 15 or fewer clients each year. So we represent a low volume but high margin type of small business. The members of our association and other hunting guides here in the state, these are really small Alaska-owned businesses. These aren't large corporate hunting operations. Mom and pop comes to mind. Land use, we use state of Alaska, public lands, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, refuges, U.S. Forest Service National Forests, National Park Service preserves. So while you may associate national parks as being closed to hunting, national park preserves are open to hunting, and some of our guides do hold concessions on national park preserves. There's increasing a use of Native corporation lands in the state as regional corporations understand the sustainable business opportunity that guiding hunters offers. We're very proud of, you'll see the highlight below there, Alaska Guides place of residency. Among Alaska's 575 registered guides in 2012, 89% were Alaska residents, while 11% were non-residents. The rate of Alaska ownership in Alaska hunting guides business is among the highest, if not the highest, of the resource-dependent industries here in the state. We've worked very hard to maintain that high rate of Alaska ownership, and it is not easy. At one time, 100% of the Alaska guide businesses were Alaska-owned. That number continues to slowly slip. The next page, I think, is important for the folks here at the table, the elected officials. It gives you kind of an accounting of where do registered hunting guides live in the state, and the answer is everywhere. Cooper Landing, Coconuck, Non-Dalton, Port Mahler, Squintna, Gakona, King Salmon, Esther, Aniak, Ketchikan, Petersburg, Two Rivers, Unalakleet, McCorick, and those are some of the smaller outlying communities that I just picked at random from that list. Of course, the majority of the hunting guides do live in the major urban centers here in the state, but these are principally a rural opportunity. The next page, I think, is important because it talks about our economic impacts in rural Alaska. I won't go too in-depth into the statistics, but slightly more than 50% of our economic impacts are felt in rural Alaska. So while and that's spending, that's employment, that's goods and services purchases, that's the holistic picture of economic impacts here in the state. Turning to the next page, you see a picture of a moose. This is something that we worked with the McDowell Group to do. We copied a similar report that was done in the Yukon Territory where they talked about, you know, sure, there's money, there's employment, but we're using valuable food animals. We're using food security, animals that are important for food security. And what do guides do in local communities with that resource? The answer is we share a lot. An individual guide can produce much more meat and sustenance than he needs for his family, and therefore the tradition of sharing meat and supporting local communities and elders across the state is very strong with the Alaska guide community, and this study here shows that we donated in or shared. I don't use the word donate because donate has a connotation of something that's unwanted. All game meat is wanted, and sharing it is something of value. So we use the word share and not donate. We shared 230,000 pounds of game meat in 2015. And then finally, there's a public partner, public-private, and I'm going to call out Representative Tallarico at this time. Representative Tallarico worked very hard during the last legislature to raise the hunting license and tag fees. He was a prime sponsor of House Bill 137, and that represents that hunting license and tag fee component is the public-private partnership that our industry participates in. Approximately, as it says here, 72% of all of the Division of Wildlife funds for managing wildlife here in the state are attributed to non-local visiting hunters. Our customers are almost 100% non-resident visiting hunters. And so not only do we derive a valuable private industry and a private sector benefit, we support the state and all of the management for everyone's enjoyment of our wildlife. I'm going to stop there with the economic information. There's a lot in these reports. I'm happy to take any questions on those. And I'm going to try to finish up quickly here. I talk about other users, federally qualified rural subsistence hunters, Alaska resident hunters, other guides, and other commercial recreational users. The association that I represent is very cognizant of the potential that we have to have conflicts with other wildlife users, and we support all types of policies to prevent conflicts and to keep our industry up to date and in line with conflict mitigation, whether it be state or between private parties. So I won't get into details on each specific use in interest of time, but I'll just say that we're very cognizant of those issues, and we have a lot of different ideas on how to solve those things, either in public policy or with private parties. And then finally, you know, the future, you know, we have an older industry. We rely on the opportunity to harvest animals. We charge a fee to do so. So those are all, as we all know here at this table, those are loaded things in the public, in the discourse over wildlife, people's values of wildlife. We are also very cognizant of that. Our first priority is a sustainable harvest. We have to support wildlife conservation, stepping forward to support things like paying more for hunting licenses and our customers' non-resident tags, very important to us because without the wildlife resource and a sustainable management strategy, we don't exist. We have the lowest priority to allocation of any of the users that rely on wildlife. Social perceptions of hunting, we realize that we have to stay up to date and we must be sensitive to other groups, hunters and non-hunters alike, perception on the take of wildlife. We work towards that, and we hope to be able to interact with the legislature and other policymakers where we can keep that up to date with society's expectations. And finally, Alaska land management policy. We work very hard with the federal land managers, and we attempt to work with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources on wise land management policies that's not just good for us, but that's good for other users and ensures a future for the guides in the state. With that, I apologize, it's probably a little bit over time, but I'm happy to take any questions on Alaska's hunting guides, our association, anything I can help the committee with, I'm happy to do so.
Well, thank you, Mr. Stacy. Really good presentation, and again, really important economic number, economic impact numbers there. Thank you. Representative Christ Tompkins has joined us, so I wanted to recognize him. Any questions from committee members? Nope. Okay. Thank you so much for your presentation. Next in our lineup is Erica Carroll. Erica Carroll is the field representative for the National Parks Conservation Association. She moved to Alaska with the Air Force, where she was the program administrator for the Nordic Ski Club of Fairbanks. Is that right? Now a member of the National Guard, she lives in Anchorage and advocates for Alaska's 16 national parks and the $1.7 billion in economic benefits contributed by visitors to the national parks. So if you would please come forward.
thank you, Co-Chair Tarr and Co-Chair Josephson, and to the rest of the members of the House Resource Committee. Again, I'm here on behalf of the National Parks Conservation Association. And my name is Erica Carroll.
Thank you.
So National Parks Conservation Association, or NPCA, I'll say for the rest of the time, it's a mouthful, is a nationwide nonprofit with members across the country. We have over 2,000 members in the state of Alaska. NPCA's will be celebrating their centennial anniversary next year, so they were established in 1919 as a nonpartisan independent voice to protect and enhance our natural resources and cultural areas known as our national parks for our future generations. So I was asked to provide some stats, as you guys have gotten a lot of already, but I think Rep. Tarr talked about how we're very plentiful in public lands here in Alaska, and to put that in perspective, the national parks system here in Alaska has 54 million acres of national parkland. To boil it down a little bit more, too, that comprises 60% of the national park acreage in all of America. So it's kind of like the Texas thing, right? We know we're bigger. We've got over half of the land to do and use for outdoor recreation, which is why I'm here talking today. So with that land, the parks here in Alaska contain unparalleled wilderness, complete with wolves, bears, caribou, and moose. So we have the world's largest salmon run, as you all know, and the highest peak in North America. We tell the stories of Alaska natives as well as the pioneers of the gold rush here with our national parks. We have 16 national parks in the state of Alaska, and even though I work for NPCA, I have not been to all of them, and I'm not sure if anyone here in the room has been to all of them. I would love to pick your brain, but I think, as we all know, sometimes the access to our national parks here in Alaska is what is difficult, but also is an opportunity for outdoor recreation. So a little more stats on exactly what it contributes, the national parks here. We have 2.7 million visitors that come to the national parks here in Alaska, and that statistics is from 2016. The numbers are just becoming published probably as I sit here from the National Park Service for 2017. Everyone expects that to go up. It's a industry that's been rising. It contributes $1.7 billion in economic benefits to the state of Alaska's economy. And it has created over 17,600 jobs here in the local communities, which we've already noted. A lot of those are not on the road system. A lot of our national parks are not on the road system, so they're in those small rural gateway communities. I'm going to boil it down here a little bit more. Just a personal experience, I think, is that I worked as the – I came up here in active duty Air Force in 2009, separated from active duty, and became the program director of the Nordic Ski Club of Fairbanks, and lived there for 5 years. We talked about winter recreation is a huge opportunity, and as we just saw mentioned with the Olympics, Keegan's going to help us show that Nordic skiing is a big part of Alaska's outdoor recreation. I know, being the director of the Nordic Ski Club for 5 years, I had a lot of calls. We, in Alaska, get some of the earliest snow nationwide, so a lot of people come up to recreate, and it's consistent snow where there has been a lack of snow in other places, or inconsistent, I guess, that they haven't been able to count on in other places. My husband and I loved Alaska so much that we decided to join the Alaska Air National Guard, and we moved down to Anchorage. And he works in the search and rescue side of it, flying, and that also outdoor recreation. I mean, the state of Alaska has the capacity to support outdoor recreation, which some states have difficult doing with search and rescue, as a side note. But to go on access, again, we had talked about the access into our national parks. That is where the local businesses come in. My first trip to a national park, outside of the road system west of the gates of the Arctic. And what that entails is it's a very long drive, so I'm going to stay at a hotel somewhere. I'm going to, because I was lazy, I'm going to eat out at a restaurant. I don't feel like cooking for myself. And also, I need transportation. So we have a lot of the local bush pilots that it's a big part of their job. That goes along with hunting as well. It goes hand in hand, which is why I'm glad to follow up after Thor, because these local businesses support not just hunters, but also outdoor recreators into our public lands, including national parks. Also, UnCruise, who's here to talk with you later, is a partner with NPCA. So we have a national constituency of 1.3 million members nationwide with NPCA, and we market to them to say, come up to Alaska, and UnCruise is one of the partners with NPCA. So you see how they go hand-in-hand, the national parks and outdoor recreation, because they don't just sit on that cruise ship the whole time. They get on and off and recreate. I have counterparts who work with NPCA in the Utah and Colorado office who I spoke to before this, and their states have an Office of Outdoor Recreation Programs, and they think it's a wonderful place to have a common voice and for outdoor recreation advocates and businesses, because right now it's happening in Alaska, but it's very hard to get all of us together, but to have one solid voice and representation at the state level would be something that would be such an investment for the state of Alaska, especially for the national park side of it. So I know we've been running short of time, so I wanted to keep this nice and short, but I'm open to any questions from any of the members.
Thank you, Ms. Carroll. Really appreciate that presentation. Any questions for the presenter? Okay. Thank you so much. We have a few more folks, so we're going to keep going here. Next on our list is EJ Reiser. EJ is the store manager for the North Face in Anchorage. He's on the corporate steering committee with North Face, the premier leader in outdoor products. He's an operational member of the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group and chairs the public search and rescue. He also serves as member of the health subcommittee of the Anchorage Trails Initiative. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you all for having us. A lot of the things that
I apologize. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Oh, excuse me. I'm EJ Reiser with the North Face. Of a lot of things I could say have already been said. What I want to kind of introduce is, I think, a hidden element to this idea of outdoor recreation, and particularly its economic impact. I think the straight line idea of this money driving force is guides and lodging and flight in and out, and what we represent is outfitting thereof, enabling. In Anchorage alone, we've been in our location for 3 years, and a big question was, why is North Face going to Alaska? I think the more appropriate question was, why did it take us so long to get to Alaska? Since we've been in our location, I think it has beget even further now. Black Diamond is opening up in Anchorage. Duluth Trading Company just opened up in Anchorage. From a outdoor recreation retail or retail specialty pointed at outdoor recreation, in Anchorage alone, we represent approximately $50 million a year, and we employ over 200 people, without even including hunt and fish, which if you did that would double both figures easily. What I think we do is make it easier for people to participate in outdoor recreation. I think relative, especially to kind of the duality of what outdoor recreation can do for the state of Alaska, is not only improve quality of life and health and make it a more marketable place for people to live and raise family, but also with the obvious angle of tourism, we're unavoidable. I think from an outdoor recreation standpoint, we are the appetizer, the entree, or the dessert, however you want to use us. We're unavoidable, and I think sometimes living in this place and being ingrained in this, we sometimes can't see the forest for the trees. We say outdoor recreation or outdoor activities. That's what people that are coming in are doing. What we call those are just activities and recreation. It's common every day. What I think you'll find is with our business, we're just fully promoting exactly this. Anything that increases activity, increases participation, increases visitation is going to expand and benefit our business and increase that and allow us to increase our hiring, increase our staffs, and drive our economy. I think what you'll also find from my personal experience with this arm of outdoor recreation is you're going to find a lot of people that are very energetic and very passionate and very driven. It's a very communal feeling. With Lee and some of the others that have spoke today and some of the preparations we've had for that, I can't stress enough how much I feel that family of outdoor recreators. And really thinking, at some point, the Hatfields and McCoys of the winters and the summers, we all exist in the same plane. And I think we can all be mutual beneficial to each other. I think a lot of people have said some great points, but I think what we drive to do is continue to make Alaska marketable, accessible, and how to extend trips one more day.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. Reiser. Any questions for the presenter? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jeff Bezos gets richer by the day, and I'm interested in just maybe a snapshot of your perspective on an on-site, a retailer with a building as opposed to a retailer with uses a P.O. box to deliver goods. I'd be interested.
That's a great point. I mean, e-commerce is an undeniable force. Some people say brick and mortar is a dying art. I hope not. I think the nuances of that are clear in that accessibility from an e-commerce standpoint is a competitor. But I think what we have and our ability in my shop or any shop is the uniqueness of being local and being that tour guide and that concierge to Alaska and to your brands as well. Anecdotal still wins. Personality still wins. I'm sure that Jeff will create a computer that can do that one day, but until then, we'll definitely coexist. But from that perspective as well, economically, there's no benefit for us to just, unless we're all going to invest in FedEx and UPS, dropping them off at the door, we still have a large job market that can exist in brick and mortar in Alaska.
Thank you.
I have a question. I'm just wondering, are there any Alaska manufacturers that you're working with, or do you, see any potential for opportunities for folks here on the ground for new product development?
Absolutely. As far as product manufacturing, we're always open. We do some outside vendor. We traditionally are 90% North Face only, but we're always interested in that. And then also participating in local, we have athletes local. And Gerda, we mentioned some the Olympics, our claim to fame. We had some Olympians as well, but game is a little more our speed, but definitely as much. And I think from a corporate perspective, it's easy to look at the big red logo, and it is powerful. But I can tell you firsthand, as the operator, I run a Anchorage, Alaska, North Face, not the
office. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd just like to say, as a wearer of outdoor apparel, all larges are not large, and all mediums are not medium. And unless you go in and try them, you don't know what you're going to get in the mail. I just thought I'd say that. Thank you.
I appreciate that, and it seems that's a shared experience among everyone. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you in Anchorage sometime soon. Next up is Chris Beck. Chris has more than 30 years of planning experience as a principal and founding partner of Agnew Beck Consulting. He specializes in the areas of community planning, economic development, and tourism and recreation. He first came to Alaska in 1979, where he worked with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources to help set up DNR's regional land planning process. In 1993, Chris started his own consulting business focusing on tourism in small Alaskan towns, including Girdwood, Cordova, Homer, and Talkeetna. Current projects with his company of 20 employees include helping the city of Aspen expand winter recreation and tourism activities, developing master plans for recreation combined with residential development in Anchorage and the Mat-Su, and land use economic development plans for the Denali and Kenai Peninsula boroughs. So welcome.
Sure. Thank you. Pleasure to be here. Appreciate you folks taking the time to listen to us one after another tell you things. I included in your packet a helpful two-pager, and I'll try to reference that as I share some ideas. I think a starting point, I like what Representative Flasher says, we have a long way to go. And in some ways, that's the heart of it. I think that the opportunities for outdoor recreation in Alaska are just barely been tapped. And by coincidence, I just spent the last week in California and Oregon, and the competition is making the investments that Alaska is not. And you go to other places and you see partnerships and embracing outdoor recreation by business, by agencies, in a way that for some reason Alaska hasn't fully got traction on. So a lot of what we're about is how to create those partnerships, how to start to invest in Alaska in a way that makes us competitive and provides all the benefits. The top of the little page gives you a list of some of those. Others have talked on that. After I take one breath so I don't just go falling over halfway through. What I want to talk about is one of the methods to reach those goals, and that is specifically really trails. And this is partially so I don't have to talk to my friends and my wife endlessly about the trail opportunities that seem so obvious and so harvestable in Alaska. So three kind of subsets of that, of kinds of trails, kinds of objectives for trails. One is those sort of world-class destination adventure things that cause people to say, I won't stay in California's Sierras or in the Cascades. I'll go to Alaska because that thing is so unique. It's a small market. Not that many people go off to those adventures. The little picture on the upper right is the gateway to the Aniakchak Caldera, which is, if you've got 8 days in a pack raft, is an amazing trip. And those guys are getting $50 a piece from three people to take us to the edge of the caldera. So it's economic benefit, but it's a small market. So the ones that are much more likely to get people using them are these things right. Also on that front page about destination towns, places where it's a great place to stay, it's a great place to get out of town easily. And then the last one, this notion of the missing middle, that there's the big category of recreation that we lack in Alaska is not the extreme adventure, of which there's a vast quantity. I think we do a really good job at the larger volume tourism. Juneau's a good example of a town that handles 1 million-plus people every year. But what people are looking for, thank you, that's service, I like this, is the kind of adventure that gives you a great day, and at the end of the day, like a bed and a beer and a shower and really good internet, and that's kind of where the market is these days. Less people are going out. I'm going out less often on 9-day trips. But I go to other places, and I want to have a good time during the day and come back to some comfort. That missing middle of the market is where we could really invest. So open your little handout there, and you'll see some examples. I won't go through all these in detail, but what these are intended to do is give some illustrative examples on how to reach those goals. And I'll start with one of the top, one that I know well, is the walk between Girdwood and Eagle River. If you know that part of the world, it's through the heart of the Chugach. It's incredibly beautiful. The trail is really hard to follow. That's my friend Bob there picking his way through the rocks. And you eventually, the culmination is you got to wade through a thigh-deep, icy river. We did. It was kind of sketchy. A lot of people would love to do that trip. Maybe there could be a bridge. You know, maybe, and this is diverging into how you do that stuff. That's a costly thing. What if the local Fort Rich Elmendorf engineers were to be partnered with the Chugach State Park and find a way to build a bridge so that suddenly people who don't want to risk their children all washing down the river could go on this spectacular hike? And it's right there close to the road system, close to Anchorage. Those next two, Alaska Hutt's Whistlesop System is a project that's been underway but slowly making progress for 20 years up the Spencer Glacier. And the one that follows, kayaks, boats, cabin system. The difference between having a great time in Alaska for many people and not is a cabin. And if you're looking to attract more people, say kayaking through Kodiak or Prince William Sound, the ability to go cabin to cabin, means that the market goes from a handful of folks to a whole lot of people. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of examples around the country and around the world where people have those. Alaska is really weak in that area. I've got a group of friends. We're trying to find that. There are very few. We're ending up not being able to do that in Alaska. We're going to go probably to Europe. I'd rather spend that money here. Alaska Long Trail. Some of you may have heard about this. Representative Chris Topkins has sparked something that's really catching fire, the notion of, you know, there's our map. That's the map of the trail, as it turns out. We arranged to have that here today. That's the pipeline. But that's an opportunity for 800 miles that it's kind of there. But it's a perfect example of where it's sort of half there, but not all the way there. There's some approvals. There's some details to be worked out. Other long trails, these are in this category of kind of nationally, globally significant opportunities. The Iditarod, there's real work going on that right now, across Kenai Trail, Copper River Trail along the former path of the Kennecott Rail, Copper Railroad, exciting things. I'll go through quick through a couple of these. There's a trail that people have been working on for some 30-plus years here in Juneau, and it's evidence of how much progress you can make with volunteers and professional trail builders and a local nonprofit, but how to push it over the top and really make it happen takes more resources. And work's underway, not quite there. Jumping to this other page, regional snow machine trails. You keep hearing about people saying, wouldn't it be great if you get on a snow machine in Eagle River and go to Fairbanks? And along the way, stop in lodges, however fast you put your hand on that throttle, every 40 miles or every 200 miles, and spend money in Talkeetna, spend money in Trapper Creek, spend money in Healy, in places that could use some spending. This destination towns notion, if you spend time with me, I talk about Bend, Oregon. I know in Alaska you talk about Oregon, people are like, couldn't you find a better example? But this place is so incredibly successful. And it's successful where it had really gone into severe decline after the timber mine closed. And the simple formula summarized here is you have to have a concentrated downtown where all your brew pubs, your lodging, your restaurants are located, rentals. You have to have trails that link you seamlessly from that to the wonderful places nearby. And then you have to have a state that spends to market that and tells people how great it is. And not just marketing the businesses, but the destination. The money flows to those restaurants, to those lodges, to those rental companies. Alaska in Southeast does a pretty good job of that. Your towns are kind of concentrated and walkable down this part of the world. The rest of Alaska, less so. And in the end, convenience drives so much of the decisions people make about where they spend their time and money. A wonderful place where you can have a job and then get out of town easy, or you can visit and not have to haggle over with your seven friends whose car's going to take to this place. In Bend, you get out of your B&B, you walk 12 feet and you're out of brew pub, or you go 200 yards and you're on a trail and you're out of town. So that kind of connection is a piece of this. This last one branches into Representative Tallarico's world, where we've been doing some planning. And in that location, the trend is more towards more activities on the edge of the park and less inside the park for a variety of reasons. And this, if you read, squint and read, it says, you know, just outside of Denali National Park. There's a need for a lot of improvements in that category. So finishing up on the last page, who's doing all this stuff? There's a huge number of folks. I mean, really an army of people are investing time and energy, and there's a list. But how to really get there? To the bottom of that page. You know, how to create this better outdoor infrastructure and experiences, how to build this stronger outdoor recreation industry. Again, the reminder, Alaska is competing and I believe underinvesting in the outdoor recreation industry. Other places are investing a lot of time and effort developing towns that are great places to live, great places to start a business, great places to visit. Alaska has lagged. If I wasn't now given to be a little cynical, I mean, I wish we'd spent like 2 or 3% of what we spent on some other major state economic development processes. Mm-hmm. We can think of grain, we can think of bridges, we can think of fish processing. A tiny bit of those hundreds of millions of dollars put into outdoor recreation would have so much impact, and we've chosen not to do so. We're hoping that we can begin to change that tide. So specifically, how can we better harness Alaska's undeveloped outdoor recreation opportunities, generate new jobs, new reasons for people and businesses to stay and move to Alaska? Three things: strategic state investments in trails and related outdoor recreation resources, thoughtful evaluation of comparative benefits of the different things. You don't want to just say if you build it, they're going to come. So let's be strategic and smart. And then finally, the stronger state leadership. And this is this notion perhaps of a state-level designated outdoor recreation advocate to help get things from stuck to unstuck and moving forward. So they're mostly by talking fast rather than.
Thank you. That was very, yeah, very, very helpful. I really, really enjoyed that. Representative Josephson with first question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Agnew, thank you for your presentation. So a couple of things come to mind, and the first is you talked about Crow Pass, and that's something I've backpacked quite a few times, and the river crossing is actually something some people look forward to because it's an adventure. But when you cross heading north to Eagle River, there is, I think it's called Seven Falls or something like that, and that's a classic place where there's a need for more infrastructure. It's a place where people make a final stop, if you will, not to color the record too bad.
Yeah.
And it's sort of disgusting. And it's the absence of investment in resources we need for outhouses and lean-tos or whatever.
Yeah.
I guess one question I have is, you talked about Bend, and I've spent some time in Walla Walla because I went to college there, and that town has been transformed. But I think it's there or somewhere else, I think it's there, where I've seen stickers that say, don't bend Walla Walla, which is meant to mean don't make us too trendy or too perfect. And it makes me wonder how, some people want the rugged experience. They don't want the bridge. How do you balance those disparate interests?
Yeah, it's a great question, and if you go to Bend, it's a little she-she for my taste at time. But Alaska has got a long way before we encounter that as a problem. I'm willing to risk some of that downside because we're sort of in first grade and they're in grad school. It's an interesting point about liking the rugged to that point. And I think it's interesting, somebody already mentioned how for Alaskans, being outside, it's not like a special thing, it's just what we do. But I think with that comes a little bit of almost snobbishness of like, why should we have signs on our trails? I don't need to have a sign on the trail. Or why should the trail from the Trop of Crow Pass down to Eagle River not be all covered with grass and you have to find your way through it? And I think it's true for me that I'm kind of comfortable. I enjoyed the trip and the river crossing. But I think if we really want to harness the potential of Alaska's natural resources environments for the large percentage of people who are uncomfortable, they're worried about bears, they're worried about getting lost, they do get lost, some areas that are improved is a good decision. Where those should be is a good question, and I'm not worried with 365 million acres of land. That's 1 million acres for every day of the year. For reference, California is 100 million acres. We've got so much wild land. I'm not worried we're going to run out. I mean, I don't know. I'm being a little opinionated on that. And there's places, we've done marketing plans in places like Cordova and Sitka and Homer, and you market three of the wonderful bays and don't tell anybody about the other four. And you know, keep it nice for Alaskans as well as attractive for visitors.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Representative Birch, and then Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Great brief. This is really good. And I've been to Bend. I like Bend. I thought it was really nice. And Walla Walla, I think that's where the state prison is, if I remember right.
And, a little harsh.
It is. One of the things we've kind of moved down here for the session, and the Treadwell Ditch, it's phenomenal. You know, aside from they need to thin out the porcupines, my dog found a porcupine over there. But I think this is a great effort. I know Bob Mintz, I've talked to him over the years about Hut to Hut in the Chugach being a great opportunity and how it's kind of advanced in Europe and other areas. But I really appreciate what you're doing here. I think we've got a great place, and I think it's a good effort and initiative to increase that. One question I have is regarding marketing. Old school marketing, you know, you package up a big package of information to somebody that's thinking about coming to Alaska next summer, and you send them, you know, 5 pounds of brochures. Aren't we past that? I mean, people do, you know, VRBOs, and I mean, you do so much stuff online.
Yeah.
Where do you see us going? How would you market this?
Yeah. I mean, I hover around the edges of people with a lot of skill in marketing, so my answer is a little more ad hoc than I wish. But I'll use Bendig as an example. If you go to the Visit Oregon website, they have something like the Seven Wonders of Oregon, and they direct people who might not know to a handful of places. And the key thing that they do that, to me, we don't do well in Alaska is they market destinations and experiences more so than businesses. I think there's an evolution towards businesses through all the mechanisms you're describing, be able to use TripAdvisor and use all Facebook and everything you use to market their businesses. What we don't do well in Alaska is make it easy and inviting to know, like, why is it exceptional to go spend time in different destinations, in Healy, in Dillingham and King Salmon, in, you know, outlying areas. And so where the marketing logic works with that model is that people go to an area and then they'll spend money. And we don't have to market individual businesses as much as we currently do. The tendency with ATIA and Visit Anchorage, and I think they would admit this, is that they market their businesses and their for-pay activities, and they tend to market less. Like, go to Anchorage. Most visitors don't know that you got your right up there, and there's wonderful hikes to be had. So I think there's different flavors of marketing, and there's some ways to take advantage of the new technologies, not sending everybody big fat brochures that they don't read. And it sets up the word of mouth that you link to Facebook and other social media so other people find out about that. But the state playing a big role, I think we've gone from 49th in the country to like 47th. In our state marketing budget, just invites us to be left behind.
Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Chris, for opening up this wonderful world. I'm fascinated by the Trans-Alaska Trail, and you're welcome for having the map on the wall. I know our colleague, Representative Price Tompkins, who just disappeared once again. That guy moves fast. is working on that project. I've always been intrigued when I'm close to the pipeline, but I'm put off by all of those no trespassing signs.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'll get shot if you get within 10 feet of this pipeline. And some people have practically been shot. How is the organization getting around that?
I think right now we're largely seeing this as an opportunity with questions to be answered. And I wish Representative Christ Thompson's was here, would give you the more precise answer. But Pat Porchot and Tony Knowles, names you may know, are actively promoting this Alaska Long Trails initiative, and that's one of the three trails that they're championing. And I think they have talked some with Alyeska, and I think that there are questions and concerns, and I would say a little bit, this is maybe reaching beyond what I know, but like you talk about trails next to rail corridors all over the country, there are trails that run along the edges of railroads, and railroads often don't like that, and they'll talk to you about the liability issues and what would happen if there was a problem, and they'll say no. In Anchorage, I know we struggle with that along Fish Creek. And in other places, they've opened up, and it's kind of worked out fine. So I think it's a matter of building confidence. Maybe there's a test case in certain areas. Maybe there's a way to move it just off to the side. I'm reaching beyond my knowledge. Mm-hmm. I think that there are discussions underway, and it just seems like the potential benefits of solving those are great enough that it's worth investing the time to see if the solutions are there.
Great. All right.
Okay. Well, in the interest of time, we need to go to our next presenter. Thank you so much. Next is Captain Dan Blanchard. Captain Blanchard grew up around boats, working alongside their family members, restoring his family's 1912 wooden tug. He earned his shipmaster's license when he was 18. He's worked in many roles as captain of sightseeing vessels at Glacier Bay Lodge in Alaska, 14 years at Alaska Sightseeing Cruise West, and today is the owner of Uncruise Adventures. The company operates 8 small adventure ships in Alaska and on the west coast of the Americas. He lives in Juneau. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It is really great to be here on a snowy day. Isn't it nice to have snow in Juneau for a change? I was worried about skiing this winter. I have a company called Uncruise Adventures, and I'd like to talk about how we grew first because I think it fits into it. First of all, this is the cruise. This is the Un. And that is so absolutely right on with who the customer is today. We're 22 years old as of December. Hoorah, we made it. And we started out as a little tiny company with a boat I leased and gave up everything I could to get this boat up to Alaska from Seattle. And in 2005, we had about four boats, and we were on a very classic line of really it was small ship cruising. And it wasn't yet adventure cruising. In 2007, we dramatically changed our model to where today we aren't in the cruise industry. We're in the adventure industry. The cruise industry, and why we're called uncruise, is because we're the antithesis of what happens on a big ship. We're using public lands. We're the largest permit or use day use holder in the Tongass, and we want to add more of those permits. And we use state lands all around. Thank you very much for keeping those up and keeping those trails working, as well as native lands and other private lands. I think what's happened is that once the World War II generation stopped traveling, you and I came into play. And we weren't happy with standing on the bow of one of my boats with a cocktail and a cigar, although I think that's a pretty good idea, really, and looking at a glacier. Today, we have to hop on the dang thing. We want to feel the cold of it. We want to cross across the lake in the middle of winter here in Juneau, and we want to enjoy an ice cave. And that is the adventure or outdoor travel industry today. It's the largest growing sector in travel. Over a three-year period, it grew 16%. It looks like that's going to be topped out in this next three-year survey that we're getting. So it's a massively growing piece of the industry. Now, the question I have when I look at this is, who is this person that's coming to visit Alaska? Because it is a different person. This person that's coming today, that tends to be anywhere from their mid-30s on up to when it's time to kick the bucket, is coming here because they want to be active. They are the types that have downsized. They've gone from the big home. They're living now in a condo. They're the types that are spending a lot of money traveling. And they're coming here because of Big W Wilderness and Little W Wilderness. And those are the things that make Alaska not only world-class, but very important to our country. It is the last frontier in many ways, as you and I know. So as we look at this, I think about where my little business has gone. From one boat, last year we had $72 million in sales, of which $45 million were earned here in Southeast Alaska. Of that $45 million, there were roughly $14 to $15 million, I don't have the exact number with me, that was dropped in Southeast communities. Now, the difference between having a small boat like ours or the adventure travel business that we're talking about in the outdoors is the money stays in Alaska. It doesn't go. Mm-hmm. And that's exciting. I sit here, I speak at Path to Prosperity quite a bit and at the Innovation Summit down here. There are young Alaskans, folks, that are so hot to get going on this. But yet, and this is my big thing for you is, are we going to stay a sleeping giant, or are we going to be hardly sleeping? And that's what I'm talking about, the outdoor business. We have this massive, massive business that we can take advantage of, where in Angoon or in Cordova or wherever, if these small businesses are well marketed, and I believe ATIA has a big piece in that, and we as a state directly have a direction for that business. In other words, we lead the path through some kind of official position, which I think is warranted. I believe that we can make this sleeping giant not sleeping, what we all do during the summer. We work our tails off. Now, as to winter business, that was mentioned earlier, I think there's a great opportunity in Alaska. I will say my own company, which, you know, we are out hiking, we snorkel. We are one of the first businesses to actually snorkel in Alaska. We do stand-up paddle boards, kayaking, and we bushwhack in Southeast like you can't imagine. But I'll say that we're expanding the season as well. We have our first boat. We're going to have a little celebration, by the way, on the 14th called Alaska Awakening. You're welcome to come down. But from April 14th through the 1st of October, many businesses are starting to operate, and that will happen over a period of time. So not only are we seeing an expanding summertime business, but we're seeing an opportunity, particularly up north, for wintertime businesses to take place as well. So we've talked a little bit. Chris kind of stole my thunder talking about the hut-to-hut, or what the rest of the world knows is trekking and T-huts is what they call them. I do it every October and November. Alaska is way, way behind, as we've heard on this. This is where, really, I believe the growth will come. We need to have
something great. We need to have the Alaska Trail or something. I hope for one right here in Juneau where I live. So why do I feel that we need this position a little bit more? As a board member for ATIA, I will say that, our efforts, as you probably have heard, are about survival right now. We have two goals, marketing and getting a TID through, and we're hopefully going to make that happen. Mm-hmm. But what ATIA does is ATIA isn't specific enough to take on a project like this. They're marketing the whole state. And working on JEDC, which if you're not familiar with the Juneau Economic Development group that meets down here on Willoughby, it's an awesome group. I sit on the tourism cluster groups all the time. And that is a tremendous kind of brain thrust of how do we get through the path of regulation and work with things. And certainly we believe that the outdoor industry and the adventure travel industry needs to partake in that. But again, that's a group that's primarily looking at the way, how can we get this stuff through? How can we get a trail through? How can we get more access to state or federal lands? So I believe that at the end of the day, that if we as a state decide to support this upcoming industry and actually get it fired up, that we're going to see a lot more dollars staying in our state, and we're going to diversify. Right now, we all know we're real heavy on commercial tourism. Wonderful. I support it. I live off the marketing that they provide as well as our own state marketing. But if we had an outdoor active adventure industry like we're seeing in other states across the union, I believe that we will bring a new person to Alaska, everyone from the backpacker kid that's 20 years old to the person I'm bringing today, which, by the way, almost all of them were traveling to Europe on $5 to $25 a day when they were kids. And now they just want to, as was mentioned before, they want to go out and venture and play hard all day. But they want that Tempur-Pedic mattress at night. And I'll bet there's a lot of hotels and Airbnbs in Alaska that can handle that, wouldn't you say? So in my mind, I'll just go back and say, do we keep this a sleeping giant, or do we hardly sleep? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Captain Blanchard. Really appreciate that. And probably just time for one question as we're watching the time here to the end. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would prefer that you characterize it as a hibernating giant. I think it's I think the potential is there, but certainly in the seasonally, at least from what we've experienced in Anchorage and South Central, just explosive growth in hotel rooms and they, those, I'm assuming that's they're built to accommodate growth in the tourism industry. But I was interested in your snorkeling adventure. I remember scuba diving off of the Cathedral St. Therese quite a few years ago, and just remarking how clear it was in January with the water with no glaciers running. So
yeah, it's beautiful out there. And I would just add to your comment about hibernating, that is really the true word. It's interesting because most of that business is surrounding major hubs that do really well on cruise passenger traffic. What we're missing right now is really the smaller businesses out in places that aren't necessarily traveled right now that could be if we could draw this adventure outdoor traveler in. Right. And this is like, what's happened. I go to India and do the Nepal thing between India and Nepal, and I've done that trail and Machu Picchu and the Inca Trail, all that kind of thing. That is the type of thing, that's the world-class thing that Alaska has the mojo for. We just don't have it yet. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Great presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think now we're going to show the short film. I think it's just a little over two minute film here, and then we have our last speaker, and then introduction of the bill. Obviously, that we did have that HCR 25 public notice, so that may come back before the committee, but in the interest of time and where we're at today, that got pulled from the schedule. So we may bring that back up, but that's one of the things that a couple of folks have referenced. And so our final speaker is Kaylin O'Brien Feeney. Kaylin is the state and local policy manager for the Outdoor Industry Association based in Boulder, Colorado. The Outdoor Industry Association unites and serves over 1,200 manufacturers, suppliers, sales representatives and retail members through its focus on trade and recreation policy and industry trends. He has over 15 years experience in the outdoor industry, serving in leadership positions for the Winter Wildlands Alliance, the Outdoor Alliance, and the Idaho Outdoor Business Council. He also worked as an outdoor educator and guide across the West. He holds a master's degree in natural resource management from the University of Idaho and a bachelor's in environmental studies from Lewis and Clark College. Welcome.
Thank you, co-chairs Tarr and Josephson and members of the committee. I want to be respectful of your time, so will you let me know how much time I have, and if I can just ditch my notes and submit testimony as well. I know we're time limited, so.
We probably have about 5 or 7 minutes, okay. So that'd be perfect. And you just, if we would state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Yep. So I'm Kaylin O'Brien Feeney. I work for the Outdoor Industry Association, and as Representative Tarr mentioned, we represent kind of the outdoor industry writ large. So members in this room include Lee and EJ, their organizations and businesses, and 1,300 other manufacturers, suppliers, retailers, folks that you've heard of, like Cabela's and Columbia, all the way down to single storefront, kind of mom-and-pop shops. And I guess in addition to all the stats that were shared here today, I might leave the committee with a little bit of a recipe for what I've seen work elsewhere as other states have endeavored to support their outdoor recreation economy to grow opportunities for residents, for visitors, for businesses. And so that's kind of what I'll endeavor to do here in a couple minutes as best as I can, kind of wrap some things together. So we're sitting here today. I've been in my role just for a few years, but 5 years ago there wasn't really anyone in any state across the country whose job it was to wake up every morning and think about how do I improve opportunities for outdoor recreation and jobs for outdoor recreation. You have land managers who do that in part. You have economic development folks who do that in part. You have people engaged in public health and wellness. You have conservation advocates. They all have a role to play here, but for the most part, states weren't yet thinking about really turning outdoor recreation from a nice to have, this thing that we all enjoy. And just to add a quick stat, a lot of the stats you've heard here today are our stats that we publish, but Alaska is winning in terms of outdoor recreation participation. You have more residents by percentage that participate in outdoor rec than anywhere. 81% of Alaskans do something on land, on water, or in the air, motorized, non-motorized, all seasons. And across the country, it's actually only 49% of Americans participate in outdoor recreation. So when I go to other states, I'm mostly trying to think and help them think about how to increase participation in outdoor recreation. It's clear from the tenor of the questions here today that you guys kind of already get it, and it's part of the lifeblood of this state. But there's more to be done, I think, in intentionally growing and nurturing this sector of the economy. So what's the recipe? There's a few things that I've seen work really well, and I mentioned that 5 years ago there weren't any states that were really doing this or having this construct. There's now 10 states, either in one form or another, where a governor set up a commission and established sort of a formal stakeholder group to think about this stuff, or that they actually hired someone to wake up every morning, like I was saying, and think about how to grow this industry and bring folks together. And really the first is simply a recognition that outdoor recreation is a need to have. It's part of the core economic future of the state. And that can be as simple to some of Lee's points as making sure that it's in the economic plan for the state so that you invest appropriately and are engaging in conversations alongside those other industries that that make up a state. And so what we're talking about here is additive. We're not trying to take the place of anything else. It's just saying, hey, this needs to be an important part of the mix too. And there's lots of ways to do that, whether it's official or not, but hopefully what we're doing here today is sharing information in that spirit to help kind of build awareness about the economic impact and the other benefits of outdoor recreation so that when you all work and when your colleagues work, there's a shared agreement that this is as important as anything else. So that's the first thing. J- just officially put a stamp down and declare that outdoor recreation really matters. The second piece is kind of related to that. And Chris and Tor and others have made points along these lines that you kind of already know a lot of the solutions here. And I don't mean to be prescriptive about exactly what needs to be done in Alaska, right? I'm a tourist, so thank you for having me. I've made annual trips to Alaska the last several years. My first trip to Alaska actually started in the Yukon, and I floated on the ALSEC all the way up to the ocean, and that was a very expensive trip, so you're welcome. I spent a lot of money between helicopters and planes on that trip, but I've come back again and again because it's an amazing place, and you know that. But all these communities are different, and you have all these different stakeholders that are different, whether they own outfitting companies or they're retailers or they're land managers, and this is a big place with a challenging geography, but they don't talk to each other enough. You already know a lot of these solutions, but the second piece is kind of convening, figuring out where that shared common ground is. The third piece that I would see being really effective in these now 10 states that are thinking about this a lot has to do with removing barriers. There's already a lot of good work happening, and it's a matter of tapping into those existing programs, whether it has to do with small business innovation funds or workforce development training, existing marketing materials. A lot of that stuff just kind of needs to get together and have an outdoor recreation focus. One great example right now, just to tease it out a little bit, is that in these 10 states, a lot of the outfitter communities has worked together to make some real changes with Forest Service about how they approach and implement outfitter and guide permitting. So we know that outfitters and guides are a huge part of this economy. It doesn't make sense for an outfitter not to have the opportunity to provide facilitated access simply because the expertise or the person to process that permit application doesn't exist within the relevant land management agency. So they've worked collaboratively, themes here, to figure out kind of a better process for doing that work in a way that still protects the environment but is kind of cheaper and easier with the goal of getting more people outside. And the last piece that I would share is that, you know, the outdoors themselves, these landscapes that you are all so rich in, are the infrastructure itself. And so baseline underwriting all of this is a need to invest in the toilets and roads and campgrounds so that people continue to have high-quality visitor experiences. And budgets are tough, but clever ideas are out there. And they're out there in the state. I know people here who have great ideas. I also know that people are trying things all across the country, and I'd be happy to share many of the things that I've seen that are really, really clever, but I think that's it in terms of time that I have for now, so I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the presenter? Representative Brauscher.
Questions, but I just wanted to thank this group of people for coming here today, and what a collection, you know. What I don't know who assembled all the different people that have testified here, but I really appreciate everything that they've had to say and all the different ideas that they've had to share and the vision that they own. And I just appreciate you all for coming. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Brauscher. Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Thank you for pulling this all together. For us, what has your experience been in other states? What would your suggestion be to us as the House Resources Committee that we can help implement and hold hands with and move forward on that has worked in other states to help open up our resources, our outdoor resources to the world and even Alaskans.
So there's a lot on your plate, and there's some pending legislation that's probably really relevant to our conversation here today. One thing that I don't see enough of, frankly, is
that you can please ask us for help, for ideas, for support, just to know that there's folks like this out there that want to support good ideas that the Resource Committee works on. That's a great first step. Mm-hmm. There's no perfect silver bullet, you know, kind of policy prescription. That's what I love most, actually, is the policy work and, mm-hmm. and really digging in and thinking about that. But I won't pretend to know what that answer is for you here. Just know that we're all figuring this out. We want to work together, and it's great to start with convening and thinking of us as allies in kind of getting towards this vision that we've been talking about today.
Follow up? And in terms of the scale, I know when I look at the map, which I'm sure you've seen of Alaska overlaid over the lower 48, sure. and I look at coming to Juneau to do my job, and I live in Anchorage full time, I'm moving from Missouri to Georgia mm-hmm. to do my job for 90 days or whatever we're going to choose to spend down here. In terms of the sheer scale, we're talking about crossing national, you know, state boundaries in terms of the space that we have to deal with in order to help people connect. And I know Juneau has done a great job. But Juneau gets a million visitors a year coming right off those ships right at the full at the foot of South Franklin Street, I know it's hard for them to venture out into the city, but those of them that do see the real Juneau. I like to call it the real Juneau as opposed to the fake Juneau that's shuttered up right now down at the bottom of the hill. And I know other communities in Southeast Alaska have the same problem. They've got a summertime, you know, a May to October season, and then everything shuts down and everybody goes away. And Alaskans are left, you know, to enjoy the peace. But just in terms of that scale, we have, and you know, and the small population that we have to provide the infrastructure.
Just kind of on a practical note, maybe the way that I've seen this industry coalesce most successfully is maybe two meetings a year, really significant meetings a year, one being in the Capitol and another roving around to rural communities that have direct connections to the outdoors. That's in some ways how Lee has set up this confluence effort over the last couple of years, and I think there's been a lot of benefit in that. You know, modern technology makes it pretty easy for us to stay in, you know, close, relevant communication, so you can work from wherever to the extent you want to. Maybe the last point that I would say there is that overall spending in terms of outdoor recreation across the country mostly happens close to home. It happens in your backyard, mm-hmm. right? It's about two-thirds of the total spending in the entire country happens within 30 minutes of someone's home. And so really thinking about those opportunities in one's own backyard is a great place to start. It's an obvious thing. It's easy to get people excited about projects that they can see from their porch. So those are just a couple of thoughts I'd offer.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I apologize because with just about 13 minutes left, we have to go on to the bill we have for today. But just amazing presentations from everyone. Really, really thank you for your time and the effort you put into those presentations. And I know we've shared your bios, but for any of the members, you know, if you want to have follow-up, we'd be happy to share contact information so that these conversations can keep going. And one of the areas where we might like to spend a little more time talking is on public lands access. Mm-hmm. And so that might be a next follow-up for this, because that's a big part of the limitation in terms of what we can do right now. And so thinking about how we might open up some of our vast areas to more people. Well, yes, now our work is done. We got to get that through, right? But thank you again to everyone for the really great presentations today. So I'm going to turn over the gavel to Representative Josephson, and I think his staff is going to come forward for House Bill 272, and we're just going to introduce this bill today. You want to come up? And maybe Thatcher can help with the PowerPoint. Yep.
Okay. We will stay on record here. And before us is a big pivot of sorts to House Bill 272. We have some invited testimony, but because of the shortness of time, I suspect we won't get to that. But let me let members know that we have Director Bruce Dale of the Conservation Division here, and I feel like apologizing to him, but then I realized that what he just sat through was probably important, if not really interesting for him. Yes, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't realize this outdoor rec program was going to chew up an hour and or whatever it has been, all entertaining and interesting. Was that on the calendar for that? I mean, pretty much for that amount of time? Okay. I just want to confirm that. And then, so this, to clarify, then this this Tangle Lakes issue is going to be introduced today, and then that's it?
That's it.
So then we'll have invited public testimony.
Correct.
Beyond.
Okay. Correct. Thank you. Yes. And so the folks that were invited and have been patiently waiting and hopefully also found the last hour plus interesting are Deantha Crockett of the Alaska Miners Association and Ruth McHenry of the Copper Country Alliance. Also online are Director Goodrum of Division of Mining, Land, and Water, John Meehan of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Steve Masterman, Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. So I hope, because those are some important public officials, that they have used their time as best they could as they waited. But with that, I would invite Ms. Delaney to put her name on the record and give us an introduction to this bill that's been referred to us from the House Fisheries Committee.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair. My name is Lisa Delaney, and I'm staff to Representative Josephson, and I'm here to present HB 272. So we've just had a host of great presenters highlight the importance of outdoor recreation and marketing and protecting our renewable resources. So hopefully I'll be able to help demonstrate the value in establishing protected areas like game refuges. Before I start, I'll just mention one of the perks of the refuge designation means that effort goes into accommodating the users of the area. So that's through trail maintenance, outhouses, things like that. So the motivations for this, the Tangle Lakes area is really important to Alaskans across the state. There is a lot of recreation and hunting and fishing that goes on in this area.
Ms. Glenny, can you go back just to give us a chance to look and also draw the microphone a little bit closer?
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. So the state has several places of note. There are four main categories. We have state range areas, we have the anadromous waters, and we have controlled use areas. There is already a controlled use area within the proposed refuge boundary. The fourth place of note, they fall under state refuges, sanctuaries, and critical habitat areas. So why did we choose a refuge? We did this because it doesn't restrict recreation, hunting, or access, whereas some of these other categories will have certain restrictions. And in terms of hunting specifically and fisheries, the boards of game and fisheries regulate hunting and fishing, so there's no impact through the establishment of a refuge. It's totally independent. Also, refuge management plans do go through public comment, so the public has a lot of say in what goes on within a refuge area. So this is the area in question. I've left some existing mining claims. There aren't currently any mining claims in the area. This just shows where they have been in the past and where the areas of interest have been. But there hasn't been enough to warrant pursuing these. The metals that have been found, it's mostly nickel, copper, cobalt, platinum deposits, and that's just one category. And I believe, as far as I know, it's fairly low grade and generates a lot of waste, which is probably why it hasn't been pursued. This area is about 156,000 acres.
And for the members' information, we have an additional map that the Department of Natural Resources has provided us, which highlights that the area that you see there in the purple that says the amphitheater, the Alpha Claim, which I think is part of the Amphitheater Mountains, is there's a lot of interest in that, but the area of the refuge is south of that area.
That's correct. The majority of the interest is north of the proposed refuge boundary. So this just gives a little bit more perspective into where we're talking about. So what else is here? Within the boundaries, there are several special and managed areas. We have Game Management Unit 13, and this is popular for hunting, and there's a lot of subsistence hunting that goes on in the area. There's also Clearwater Creek Controlled Use Area, and this area is currently closed to motorized vehicles, although the Board of Game is revisiting that. There's a lot of moose and caribou in this area, and it's really popular for the walk-in hunters. There's also the BLM-managed Delta National Wild and Scenic River Corridor, and this focuses on bird species. And then we have the Tangle Lakes Archaeological District, and that actually takes up a pretty sizable portion of the proposed refuge area. And this came about due to a lot of valuable cultural resources that have been found in the area. And these areas will keep doing what they do with or without the refuge designation. The refuge designation will just help to regulate more destructive development on otherwise renewable hunting and fishing grounds. So this is, it shows where the Nelchina caribou herd is. You can see the pink circle there. There were 5,000 caribou tags this year in Unit 13, and it's the sixth largest herd in Alaska. And again, as I mentioned, it's the subsistence hunt as well across the state. So we've had overwhelming support for this refuge, and this has been an ongoing process for over a decade now. And Ruth, who is or was on the phone, can speak to this a little bit more. She represents the Copper Country Alliance and has been spearheading this movement pretty much since inception. We have had 713 individuals sign on to a letter that you have just been handed, and there are 108 organizations.
And I, if we could go back, I know we have limited time, but I'll ask you, since you're testifying and I'm not, Robert Toby, who's in the PowerPoint there, is the first bullet point, worked for who was then newly elected Governor Murkowski, is my understanding. And the administration at that time, or that administration, supported the creation of a refuge. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
Okay. And then Mr. Judkins was chairman of the Board of Game in the Palin administration, and the Board of Game recommended the same thing. Is that your understanding?
That is correct.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, your name and association through the chair?
Through the chair? Lisa Delaney. I work for Representative Joseph.
Okay, and I'm sorry. You know, I struggle with this as kind of another land grab, and I as a mining guy, I'm just looking at this with some concerns about kind of the initiative behind this and the timing, and I'm just hoping that we have an ample opportunity for public engagement and recognition that that there can be shared use there in the property. And I don't know in the room here how many people have driven across the Denali Highway. Everybody? That's good. Okay, so we're all familiar with it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Please continue.
Okay, thank you. So I'll just give a quick overview of the actual bill. So Section 1A is basically 7 pages that describe the boundaries. And these boundaries more or less follow the geography, but they do use parcel boundaries in the legal description, which makes it easier to map out. Section 1B, it describes the purpose of the refuge. And again, this is to protect our subsistence uses and hunting and fishing, as well as recreational, scientific, aesthetic, and educational purposes. So it's basically everything that utilizes the renewable resources and the ecology and land on which these resources depend. And this is to benefit all Alaskans. So Section 1C through F, it provides land use restrictions on mining and potentially oil and gas unless the commissioner deems it compatible with the refuge. It addresses the access corridors to this land. It gives DNR and ADF&G authority to enter into leases, again, provided that the leases, the use is compatible with the refuge. And it prohibits the sale of land within the refuge boundary. And Section 3 provides an effective date of January 1st, 2019.
We have a question from Representative Johnson. Let me ask you real fast, though, Ms. Delaney. The previous slide, two slides back, have you spoken or communicated with the Division of Mining, Land, and Water about active present-day interests in mining?
Yes, Co-Chair, I have.
And what is it that you've learned?
There are no mining claims in the refuge boundary at this time.
Okay. And are they, when you say there are no mining claims, are they being actively explored and pursued, or are they technically claims, but they're dormant? I mean, do you understand?
My understanding is that there are no claims. Nothing is currently being pursued actively in the area.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think this is a beautiful area. No question about that. But I do wonder, I'm always wondering when we have so much public land or land that's not in private ownership in Alaska already, when we prohibit additional lands from being sold. Can you tell me how much state land and how much private land or potentially that would be sold into private ownership would be? I mean, I don't necessarily know if you'll have that right off, but I would like to find that out.
Through the chair, are you asking how much of the proposed refuge is currently state land?
So, well, here's the thing is I don't know what borough this is in. Is this in the Denali borough? No. Matsu borough. No. Okay, Matsu borough. Okay, so private landowners pay property taxes. And without, you know, with as things decline, state revenues decline, private ownership of land, of course, is important, but also the property taxes for any number of things, whether it's the any number of things. So I'm just trying to figure out what kind of potential revenue decrease that we could have to the Matsu borough. So how much private land, or not private land, but state land that was intended at statehood to go into private ownership is there to be transferred that would be taken away from that potential revenue base?
Through the chair, I'm not sure offhand. I'd have to look for you.
This was something I'd like to find out.
We'll see what we can find. Representative Rauscher.
Yes, thank you very much, Chairman Justin. I appreciate the comments so far. I can tell you that the Matanuska Borough basically only encompasses this little bit right here, okay, over here. That, from this area right here over, on that line, it's on the map. The rest is not. It's actually in the
unorganized borough.
Okay. I just wanted to address that. Number two, I'm not. I don't have the complete definition on the mining claims that are there, but there are mining claims that are not being mined anymore. Okay, they used to be, and it is my understanding that they have apparently been, I don't know whether the good word is abandoned, but they aren't in operation and they are not being mined anymore, and I believe they have been returned to the state, but that doesn't mean that they cannot be sold again. It just means that presently they are not being mined and not being controlled by a lease agreement. That's my understanding. But I could be corrected, though. Thank you.
You know, we could take a couple minutes and see if a gentleman who would be very patient if he's still online. Mr. Goodrum?
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Goodrum, to Andy Josephson and Juno, there's a question about the status of mining claims in the region that would be covered by this bill. We know that most of the claims are in the southeast corner of the area close to the Denali Highway. What is your understanding of their status? And how would you describe their status?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, for the record, Director Brent Goodrum, Division of Mining, Land, and Water. My understanding was last time that we had checked that there weren't any active state mining claims within the proposed refuge boundary. And so previously you may have had claims that may have been active that miners had let expire or essentially abandoned the claims. So my understanding is at this time there aren't any active ones. However, the staking of mining claims is a is something that a miner can go and upon discovery can stake it and record it, and it's a self-actuating right. And so an individual can go out and stake claims, and then we may find out after the fact that that happens. But currently, it's our understanding that there aren't any active claims within the refuge boundary at this time.
Okay. Any follow-up on that, Representative Rauscher?
Yes. I guess my question would then be to the same gentleman would be, thank you, through the chair. My question to the same gentleman would be, there were some that were active at one time that aren't now. Can those exact same mining claim areas be leased to somebody else going forward in the future by the state?
Mr. Goodrum, can you, to the extent you heard that, can you help us with that question?
Yes, through the chair, again, for the record, Director Brent Goodrum. Well, yes, an individual or a party or a group could come into acquiring rights to minerals in those areas, either through staking or through some type of lease with the state. That is something that could happen in the future. So that is not prohibited at this time. As most of you know, all of Alaska state lands are open to mineral entry unless they are otherwise closed. So that is something that could happen in the future. There has been exploration in this area previously, and so that could happen yet in the future unless there was something else that prohibited it.
Just one follow-up from Representative Rauscher, and then we're going to have
one more, and then I'll stop. Yep. I just want to know, will this piece of legislation stop that from happening?
Well, actually, that's a good question. Director, the legislation would prohibit future mining claims. Could someone take in some way an existing claim? To your understanding, we may need an attorney general to give us their opinion, but could they reinvigorate what had been a claim under this bill in your mind?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, someone could go out, a miner could go out and stake a mining claim and then record that mining claim, and then they at that time would secure rights to those minerals. And so the bill speaks to, in section, I think it's 1C, dates that says, except for valid rights and interest in mineral claims existing on January 1st, 2019. And so theoretically, if this bill were to go forward and be enacted and signed into law, if someone were to stake a mining claim prior to that date, they would acquire that right and be able to utilize that right going into the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, and thank the gentleman on the phone.
Thank you. At this time, we are going to, of course, hold the bill. We have not heard our invited testimony, which was designed to be from the Alaska mining industry and from the Coffer Country Alliance. We have not heard public testimony. That's calendared for Wednesday. Do look at your calendars that will be published tomorrow. And the Friday schedule includes House Bill 27, I believe, on hazardous
contaminants.
And DNR disclosure. So our calendar for Friday is House Bill 27, High-Risk Chemicals for Child Exposure, House Bill 330, DNR disclosure of confidential information. And we also have calendared further discussion of amendments on 355, which was the sort of fire omnibus bill. And with that, unless there's any questions, we'll adjourn at 3:10.